The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
You know, the jet at high speeds, talking above 300 knots, you can get a 40 degree per second roll rate out of this thing, which is wild. It's like, you know, people are like, what's it like flying the C-17? And the only thing I can describe it as, it's like the NFL lineman that can somehow run a 4.5 40. Like, you look at the jet and you're like, there's no way that it can do the things that you see it do, but it can. And also learning the jet does talk to you, but it's very nebulous. You kind of have to know the systems and what they're telling you at any given time to keep yourself safe when you're kind of trying to push it out toward that outer limit. So that's the toughest thing, as far as specifically flying the jet. In general, like I said before, it's just trying to do everything all the time is incredibly difficult, and stay good at everything all the time is a problem for us.
I will piggyback on that. If you haven't seen the C-17 demo, for those who are listening, that's an impressive demo to watch. I mean, it's a big old plane maneuvering in a small piece of the sky.
Yep.
The assault landing, or the short field landing demo portion of it, and backing up, like I can respect. That's a big old plane to be whipping that thing around like that.
I love it and I hate it. And I'll tell you why.
Tower Demire Spaces, release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altimeter 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire project clear, low speed, fire project clear.
My bird ramp curveball at 354.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining in. My guest today is Prada. He's a C-17 pilot, evaluator pilot, weapon school grad, weapon school instructor with a few thousand hours flying the mighty Moose. Over 200 combat missions from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Horn of Africa, and a few other places. We dive deep into his career as well as the C-17. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. He hung around for a There I Was story. And again, you can get those as a Patreon subscriber or over on Apple Podcast as a podcast subscriber there. If you're getting any value out of this content, I always ask, just leave a rating review over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. That helps the show out. And again, make sure you're following along in all the appropriate places. With that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Prada. Prada, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man. Happy to have you on here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rain.
Dude, just looking at your bio, we got over 3,500 hours flying around, 200 plus combat missions. You've flown in Kuwait, Qatar, Kyrgyzstan, combat ops in Syria, Iraq, Africa, Afghanistan, probably a few more spots just to name a few. So I think we have we have enough to talk about today. And then I mentioned like weapons school, graduate instructor, missile defense agency. We'll cover some ground here. But I want to kick it off, man. Of all those places, of all those hours, of all those combat missions, what was the spiciest one that pops to mind?
Oh, the spiciest one. So I'll go the operational story and the training environment story are two very different ones. So I'll go operational first. So operational one, we'll keep it kind of vague as far as setting wise, but we're in like a very, we'll call it the Wild West, African continent, right? And so this is years ago. I was like a fairly new aircraft commander. Wasn't even quite an instructor yet at this point. So my bubble was a bit smaller, but, so I get this tasking to go into middle of nowhere, Africa, and I'm starting to do like some study on the airfield and stuff like that. And there is nothing like, and I start making phone calls like, you know, why am I not finding like any surveys? Like, what is the deal? And they're like, oh, we don't have any. That's what we want you to do. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to need like a lot of signatures, I'm going to need a lot of like approvals to get, before I go do this thing. And, so we end up going, we pick up, the user on the stateside, blast out. I think we spent like probably a night in Germany or something like that, head into country. And we're like literally doing a low approach to see like if there's livestock on the runway. There's no fence line, you know, like we're carrying cash to to like pay for our landing fees. I'm sure it was a complete racket, but whatever.
No joke.
And so we really didn't have like the ton of intel gaps, which like, as you know, like the most dangerous thing are the things you don't know. So we're going into this fairly blind. They asked us to go in during the day, which would not have been my preference. But I probably should have put my foot down a little bit more on that. So we land, the user's doing, I assume, some kind of like recovery or rescue mission, but you know, we didn't talk too much about that. And I think they had anticipated us just dropping them and leaving, but I didn't want to do that. I said, hey, like if your equipment breaks down, like what's your plan to get out? And they're like, we're on our own. I'm like, okay, well, let's set up a comm plan. I'm not going to leave you here. This is how much gas I got. And I'll check out with you when I leave the area. So everything goes pretty smooth. We do like a low beam approach, pop up, no like hazards on the runway. We land. And I notice as we're in the downwind, there's kind of like a village pretty darn close. I'm going to say like within a mile, to the airfield. And there was no reporting on that previously. So we land, they offload, get their equipment up and running. We do a comm check. They blast off. Well, in that time, people start like coming out of the village. And we don't know anything about these people. We don't know if they're going to be a problem or not. We had also brought our own security with us called Raven Team. So before we had left home station, back up real quick, they were going through their ROEs with me. And basically, they couldn't have, in this particular area, their ROE was no weapons off the aircraft. So they're out there, we call it like their verbal judo, and that's all they got to work with. So,
great.
Like they had weapons, but they weren't allowed to be at the ready. So thankfully, I convinced them to bring their wireless comm kit, so we at least had comms with them, and they're giving me updates as the congregation of people increases. And we're getting like more uncomfortable. So the user blasts off, they do their thing. And now instead of them breaking, which was the contingency we planned for, my jet breaks on the LZ. So we can't get the door shut, which is like the stupidest thing, you know, to think about, but obviously it can't take off. So we're like, we could get it to like the coplanar position, but we couldn't get it the door and ramp to close up completely. So I got a crew chief, like a flying crew chief in the back. They're working on that. The load masters are doing everything they can do to try to get the door shut. And all like, there's just more and more people gathering, on and around, or not on, but around the aircraft. Thankfully no one's on the runway yet. Like it's not quite a HKIA situation, obviously not in scale or to that hazard level. But we were stuck there for another 30 minutes. Thankfully, like no weapons, like they said they saw weapons at a distance, no weapons were used. But it was probably the most volatile situation that I've seen, operationally. So lots of things could have gone wrong in that one. Thankfully they didn't. And then we're able to blast out of there and get out. So that was pretty, that got almost really bad, really fast.
Yeah. I mean, one tip of the hat going sideways there. I assume that field, was it unprepared as far as, was it concrete or
it was,
asphalt?
I'm sure it was a prepared strip at one point in its history. By the time we got there, it was kind of crumbling, which honestly is worse for us. You know, you get an asphalt field that's just chewed up, and now I got a big FOD hazard that I'm worried about. So that was another issue that we were trying to be cautious of, if we were going to be able to get out of there and not like suck up any asphalt into the engines.
So I know you're being rather broad, for a reason, but I assume C-17 was a platform vice a C-130 there, probably based on like the leg needed to cover and the distance and time.
100%. Yeah, so with missions like that, it's time sensitive for sure. And then just being able to get into country and out just wasn't going to be possible for a 130 in the time frame that they had to work with. So
how'd you get the door up, flying crew chief?
Dude, I still don't know to this day. Like The flying crew chief, probably took a wrench and just like beat on something until it did he wanted it to do. And I was like, okay, I'm good. Let's get out. So, yeah. So that was the highest like potential, issue that I've had operationally. Training, I've had way more close calls in training, and you probably have similar stories, like just wild stuff happens on training lines.
Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, fortunately, I guess I always had an ejection seat. C-17, yeah, you're more limited in options and less maneuverable. Yeah, yeah, it's like love the one you're with, I suppose.
Yeah.
What's the spiciest training sort you've had?
Spiciest one, a couple like individual events, but I'll go with, so this is probably, this is 2017, Weapon School JFE, largest formation we had ever put into the knitter at night. It was a 38 ship of C-17s. And so yeah, that in the daytime can get really spicy. And we had upped the like kind of threat picture that we've seen in previous Weapon School JFEs. So we knew that there was going to be probably a spin at some point, but the spin contract is obviously predicated on the student's plan and how they're going to break up those 38 aircraft and get into the holding pattern. So, what ended up happening and why it got so spicy so fast is like, of course, at the absolute worst time, we get a spin and one of the elements doesn't catch the call. So now we start the reversal and we're like, we're beak to beak. And not only that, we're at the point in the knitter where the terrain starts to become way more of a factor. So I'm on an NVG corridor, you know, right up against terrain. And I'm like, I'm literally like turning my head and trying to catch through my NVGs the other element of C-17s, because they said they were stacking over top of us. In like, we have like basically greenhouse windows that are up on the top of the C-17, and I can't see them through the regular glare shield. So I'm trying to look up and catch them through this like little port window, and I see them like whiz by at probably like 500 feet or less. And I'm like, my pucker factor was really high at that particular moment. So it probably took us, I mean, it took us a couple minutes to get it straightened out, but, that was the closest I've been like opposite direction, 500 feet or less at night on NVGs, low illumination. The moon wasn't even up yet. So
that was, I got some follow-up questions with that. I'll point out for those listening, Knitter, the training area north of Las Vegas. That's where we're talking about red flags on the podcast. That's where everything's happening. But Joint Force Exercise for Weapons School, throwing a lot of planes in there. I've never heard of someone missing a spin call ever. That's usually like when the B-52 ends out front. And for those listening to, when you say spin, like that's a call for the entire force package. They're typically a 3-minute spin. So everyone's going to basically delay 3 minutes, but you know, an F-16, you're literally going to do a 360 degree turn and then keep on pressing. What are you going to do in a C-17?
It depends on the size of the formation, right? So in that case, because we were so strung out, I mean, the whole formation, you're talking 38 jets. And I think we had like 4,000 feet between each aircraft. So we're like almost 70,000 feet long, if you can imagine, just this centipede of C-17s. Yeah. And so at that point, because we're sequencing different points on the route and making turns, I can't really follow the formation lead around. One, it's going to be a longer spin than they wanted. So we end up spinning by element, which is typically typically three jets. And what happened was, because we're low altitude, one, all of the radar players, like your AWACS and stuff like that, they can't see us at this point. And I've been in the ground station that like backs up the AWACS that you're probably familiar with. But they also have a ton of radar feeds. The first time I was in there as a student, when I went through Weapons School, like, they were freaking out because they couldn't see, they lost all the C-17s off of radar. So nobody can see us on radar, and line of sight radio coverage can be pretty dicey. So we were relying on a relay from the seed team lead. So I think in that case, it was a Viper driver. makes the call on the war frequency, and that has to be echoed by one of the C2 elements. So either what I suspect happened is either that relay was delayed, and so anybody that was in line of sight to the seed team lead got that call. So they make their turn just as planned. But the people that are further back that are out of line of sight, if they don't get that relay, now we're beak to beak.
Ooh.
So it was hairy.
Yeah, that could have been real bad. C-130 has, is it MADL? Is that their data link where they are they ski rope, they tie together? Can the C-17 like tie in and fly formation, or is it manual?
We do. Yeah, we do that. And so that's how we basically maintain that positive deconfliction. But the closure rate was so fast. I mean, we're quite a bit faster than the C or the C-130s. So we're doing 330 knots. It's about Mach 0.5 for all our pointy nose friends. So, you know, you're closing at Mach 1, basically. That happens very quickly. So in the time that I'm doing my 180 and making sure I don't hit terrain and I abide by my corridor that we've done all our terrain analysis in, and then I realize that C-17 is pointed at me, not away from me, I got probably, you know, 6 to 9 seconds to figure out how we're going to not hit each other.
Oh, man. I don't know. Just also, too, for those listening, like, if you think about putting 38 C-17s up in the air, along with all the fighters and bombers, like, talk about America and just our air power, like, making that happen from the maintainers, logistics, the fuel, air traffic control, like, everyone coming together to make that happen. It's a pretty impressive sight.
It really is. And I had the opportunity to get, when I went back as weapons school cadre, I ran that phase. So it was great to really get a deeper appreciation for all those folks that you mentioned. And that's just a short list, as you know, like anybody from like the maintainers to all like the life support equipment folks, that's such a big lift, for the whole like enterprise, if you will, for that operation specifically, but definitely the weapon school integration phase, that whole month is just massive.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.
Which is, I just think about, so F-16, right? Like the lip light, being able to turn your lip light on your mask.
Mm-hmm.
That's aircrew flight equipment. You know, if you don't have a lip light, man, it's like code 3. This mission is an abort. It's a no-go. And it's just something as small as that, like everyone doing their part to make it happen. It's pretty impressive to see when it all comes together.
Yeah, it really is. It was a hugely rewarding experience to be able to go through as a student and see all that stuff happen then from the cadre side. You know, everybody, there's no room for JV players when you're talking about an operation of that size. Like, everybody's got to bring their A game for sure.
How does the C-17 run the weapons school? Because it's not based out of Nellis, right? I assume you guys...
It's a geographically separated unit. So basically all of your platforms that are bigger, that includes your B-52s, the Bones, all of the wide-body aircraft essentially are going to be off-site because there's just not enough ramp space. So for the C-17s, we used to be on the East Coast at McGuire, and then they moved, as it should be, moved it back to McCord, really just for the support aspect. The story goes there was some like Congress person that wanted the weapons school to stay at McGuire, and that's why it was there for so long. But it's a non-airdrop base, and we can get into that. Not everybody in the C-17 is airdrop qualified. Not every base does airdrop. So the support functions weren't there. So we moved it back to McCord, I want to say 2017, and it's been there ever since. So the first couple of phases are at McCord, and then they go do a deployed phase where they lose a lot of their connectivity. So they're basically all like local network only planning. Okay. And so currently that one's done out of the Phoenix area. We've been out of Arizona, bounced around LA, Kirtland, and a couple of different bases, but it gives a lot of opportunity. You got like everything in Colorado, all the high PA fields in that area. You got a bunch of semi-prepared like dirt strips in the Southwest United States. So a lot of great training opportunities for the deployed phase. And then the last one, we already alluded to, everybody goes to Nellis. And so then at that point, it's all your bros and broettes that have been doing it for getting the best that they could be in their own aircraft. Now you come together and, you know, you learn how to do it as a team. So it's kind of that capstone event.
Is the initial phases too, I imagine, like in the fighter world, they're doing a lot of BFM and kind of blocking and tackling, building. In the C-17, is it doing a lot of the things that you don't necessarily do on a regular basis? Like I would imagine like high density altitude, assault landings, heavyweight, tactical approaches. Like what does that initial phase look like building up to the joint force?
Yeah, the great part about the course is it's all building block. And I think all the other platforms are pretty much the same, but this kind of gets into like the C-17, like identity crisis, if you will. Since not everyone is airdropped, the experience that you get as a C-17 operator can be vastly different depending on how you were raised. So the first month is kind of, well, I'll say the first 2 months are really designed to level that playing field. So the first phase is maneuver theory. That's really just learning how to handle the C-17 to the outward edge of the limits of the aircraft. And then second phase, which they're finishing up now, is the defensive tactics phase. So I actually just got to go fly there with the students, went back and helped out for their capstone for that phase. So, you know, I'd like to see someday those get truncated a little bit so we could focus on more like advancing the tactics in the community. But as it stands now, those are your playing field leveling phases so that everybody's on the same page going into the deployed and then the integration phase.
Why the difference between airdrop qual, non-airdrop qual? Why are there different bases and what are they?
So your airdrop bases are, so we call them super bases, where you got multiple squadrons. So that's McCord and Charleston. Obviously Schoolhouse, Altus has Altus, Oklahoma. Lovely Altus by the sea.
Yeah. Everyone's favorite. So
yeah, everybody's favorite. They have airdrop. And then your PACAF bases. So your Elmendorf and Hickam all have airdrop. So on the flip side of that, you got McGuire, Dover, Travis. They do, and then we'll just keep it to active duty for now. They do not have airdrop. So there's a ton of reserve and guard units that have C-17s now. That's a whole different can of worms. It's largely a money problem, as it's been told to me, and a support problem. So it's a whole different set of equipment, obviously, to keep the C-17s up and running for airdrop. Just how the platforms are rigged, and then airdropped, you got to have contracts to go recover those bundles that you drop for training. So, and then just the tax on the community for just airlift, right? So I think it's a balance of trying to satisfy all those worldwide requirements. So we kind of have two different dads, if you will. We have like Transcom, which is driving a lot of our airlift, like the strat airlift, as we call it, requirements. And then you have like AMC, which is, you know, more just our MAGCOM specific. So just a lot of pulling at threads, you know, trying to make the machine go. So
all the C-17s, I imagine, are capable of doing it. I know that maybe there's some equipment in the back pushing out, but you know, if you think of F-15E versus C, people are like, oh, it's an Eagle. Well, no, those are like vastly different planes with vast different capabilities. Same with the F-16, the different blocks.
Yep.
Is C-17s, are they all apples to apples or is it apples to oranges?
I mean, I would say maybe like a Granny Smith to like a Golden Delicious. Like they're all apples. But like you said, that they'd have to have some equipment swapped out, make sure everything's up and running. But yeah, it's not quite the same as like a Strike Eagle versus C model as far as the differences go.
Okay, full disclosure. I have no idea who, like the Gaza airdrop. I would like to talk about that. I don't know if it was us, if it was an ally, what it was coming off of. I think probably caveat. There have been some tragedy, people getting crushed by pallets. Like one, people
So
don't realize how heavy those are. But yeah, like what?
they
Yeah, talk to
are.
me about that.
I'll tell you what I know, which is not certainly not everything. So the first one that happened, well, about 2 weeks ago now, that was an allied nation. You can't, I don't know what country that was. All I know was it was not US. Which is good because when I saw the video, I had, trying to avoid the Monday morning quarterback, but there's a lot of things that I personally would have done differently. The altitude was really high. So for all my bomb dropping friends, like you guys are able to measure your error in feet as far as dropping munitions. Like mine's in hundreds of yards. And the reason for that is every second that a bundle is under shoot, Sir Newton gets a vote, right? So every variation in wind is gonna have an effect. And then what kind of shoot you're using. So there is a matter of weaponeering, if you will, for C-17 airdrop, like what type of shoots I'm using. Some are more accurate than others. I have high velocity and low velocity shoots. I can't necessarily pair them with everything. Obviously, well, maybe not obviously. It's probably unwise to drop gas, barrels of gas on a Hy-Vee chute, because you have a increased chance of those having an unfortunate arrival at their destination. So all that said, that the first video that you saw going viral on the internet, not us, and also I would was fairly hopeful that it was not us because it didn't look like our typical tactics. They used Hy-Vee chutes on that first drop, and I think that's what caused the issues. You noticed probably, I don't know how many times I watched the video, like a couple dozen times
Yeah, but
as a
yeah,
as an
fair enough.
interested party. You noticed like a couple of the bundles did not get a fully inflated chute. And that can happen. If you have a, we can carry 40 bundles in the C-17. And so those last couple can often get starved for air and the chutes may not open properly. So
Interesting.
yeah, so all things to consider when you're trying to get that accurate drop. I did see another video yesterday. I was not able to find out who did that one. That looked more like us, low V shoots, and a little bit better. Still really high, in my opinion, as far as trying to get that dispersion down to the minimum level to avoid that civilian hazard, which has got to, it's got to be at the forefront of your mind when you're doing humanitarian drop. Like, what's the point of, in us doing this if we're dropping bundles on kids, right? So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Probably, I mean, I don't know anything about you. Obviously know much more than I. I can imagine that they might have been capped altitude wise when they didn't want to be capped. Just
Yeah.
as we've seen, sometimes the handcuffs get put on and like this is a dumb this is what's gonna happen and still have to press forward.
Yeah, and that happens, I would say, from my time at the AOC and the Air Operations Center, kind of seeing the behind the scenes aspect of this, and then also being able to talk to other folks that are, dropping bombs and whatnot, because an airdrop is not an immediate need, like I'm like close air support or something like that. What my experience is, we have typically the handcuffs are a bit worse on the airdrop side. And that also plays in if we back up a little bit and we have, let's say we have typically like a colonel's going to be in charge of the air mobility division. And then a one star will be the liaison from like the mobility side to the CFAC, so you're basically your commander of all the air forces in theater. There's that go between, and depending on who that individual is, they're going to have a different risk lens than others may. So that issue, when we talk about what I call the C-17 identity crisis, like depending on what path you've taken, you can get a completely different perspective in risk, in capabilities of the aircraft, which can really can end up causing mission risk to rise because we're not willing to or don't understand what the full capabilities of the C-17 are because you may not have that experience. So it can definitely compound pretty quickly.
Yeah, interesting. That's an aspect clearly I've not thought about, but I could see that coming to a head at the wrong time, depending upon what your career path was and what you flew.
Yep. Like, I've been on the receiving end of that in the bad way many, many times.
never heard of anyone else. So yeah, it's first time.
Yeah.
I can also say is like probably those pallets all too, they got to weigh a couple thousand pounds a piece. So even if they're hitting the ground at 5 miles an hour or 10, I don't know what the desire is. Like, that's still a lot of like science and math underneath that between that and the ground. So you don't want to be underneath one of those. So
interesting. Okay. Not.
Yeah. Good to hear your take on that. Dude, I want to backtrack and back it all the way up.
Sure.
What got you started and interested in aviation? What was your path to flying the C-17?
I guess I'm just outrageously stubborn. So I had never, I had one flight on one airplane, commercial flight when I was a kid. And I just like knew that's what I wanted to do. So a lot different than some of the other people I've heard on the pod and you and a lot of my friends like, oh, you know, I grew up my uncle or my dad or, you know, I got my PPL before I learned to drive. I'll say I had a fairly modest upbringing and that just wasn't in the cards for us. So I grew up like real small town, Pennsylvania, and like we weren't on a farm, but surrounded by farmland and wilderness and stuff like that. So okay. I knew two things. One, I wanted to get out of my hometown and see what else was out there. And I guess three, I wanted to join the military. And then when I did that first flight, I figured the best way to do that was fly airplanes. So I chased that obviously pretty far. Went to Penn State, did ROTC there, and then got picked up for a pilot slot and ended up at Laughlin, also by the sea.
Yeah, two great spots. Laughlin to Altus, man. Nailing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no place better. What was your first C-17 assignment?
I was at McGuire. So yeah, I went, I was late to rate on the airdrop side. Kind of knew I wanted to do that. And it just wasn't in the cards assignment wise, but as soon as I arrived at McGuire, you know, kind of expressed my interest in moving on to an airdrop base. And, my AOC tour, the Air Operations Center, kind of bought me that. That was kind of the trade for my operational assignment to McCord Air Force Base out here in Seattle area. So after that, got here and picked up airdrop, never turned back.
What's the footprint of doing like an airdrop upgrade? How difficult is that?
The initial upgrade's not bad. You just get to go back to Altus several more times.
Okay.
So it's a co-pilot upgrade. And basically the co-pilot upgrade is you're doing all mission computer stuff, making sure that calculation that you alluded to is all correct and the jets track in where you need to drop. And then after that, you'll go back, you do aircraft commander upgrade, and that's more formation flying. So the assumption is you're already good enough at running the mission computer and you're going to run the formation now as a two ship. And then eventually you can bump up to a lead. I would say the closest equivalent, probably the four ship lead for the Viper. What I know of it. Not saying they're equivalent, but I'd say it's the closest. So that one you're doing a lot more. You have to do integrated sorties with other assets. You got to do large formation stuff, like 6-12 ship stuff like that. And so that upgrade's pretty hard to attain. To the point that we actually created like an intermediary that you can do like a three ship lead at that point, but not do all the extra integrated stuff just because we couldn't produce enough leads to make the machine go.
Yeah. You start thinking about it. And again, this is one of the things we talked about, like retention and pilots and back and forth, but how much time, effort, energy, money, and resources does it take to create, in this case, you know, a fully qualified airdrop pilot? Like, that's a lot of iron. That's a lot of pallets being built, being thrown out the back, being picked up, done. I mean, there's so many moving pieces to this that you can't just copy and paste and make another one when someone leaves or gets out.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's obviously all communities in aviation, the military, having this problem now, specifically in the Air Force, but just bleeding talent consistently, people getting out. So I took an AGR tour. So I went and got picked up by Delta, came back as an AGR, and it's been a great opportunity for the family. I'm attached to a reserve unit. So yes, the reserves can get activated and deployed, but it's not, the volatility isn't there. But I can still teach, and I do, you know, I fly as much as I can, still go back and help out at the weapons school. So it's a pretty happy medium, I have to say. And one that's not being really flexed by big Air Force. And I think it should be. I think that solves a lot of your retention problems if you just make a lot more AGR positions.
Man, you know, if I, you know, part of me is, dude, if I had to go back and do it all over again, I think I would absolutely do the exact same thing, because it obviously has landed me to where I'm at today and what I'm doing.
Sure.
But we've had this conversation a bunch with other people, like, the thing I wish I had known, like, I showed up to pilot training, and then there's the guys who are like, oh yeah, I know I'm going to go fly a C-17, an F-16. You're like, what do you mean? Like, oh yeah, I'm a guard or a reservist. I think like the golden ticket is, like, if you could get hired by a guard or reserve unit, but you, like, beforehand, if you could somehow get your hours, get your airline job, so you get your line number, and then go on mill leave and go to your guard unit, you could do that, rack up your seniority, and just bounce back and forth, like, over the years, like, be a pretty good quality of life, I think.
But, yes. I don't know why we don't have more, like, true total force integration, they call it TFI units, where it's an actual blend of active and reserve. The reason I would say that's important is, so for instance, I got a couple of lieutenants that are going through their seasoning tour now, but that's only, they're lucky they got 2 years. Typically you only get a year and then you're back to part-time status. So when you're talking about trying to make a good aviator that can eventually deploy and do the things that we need them to do, that's a tall order in a year, fresh out of schoolhouse to get that done. So if you had that TFI unit where you could siphon that knowledge off the full-time positions that are active duty, and then you got your old graybeards that have seen just like a wild amount of weird situations, to me, that's like the way to go. And it's just not, there's not too many of them around.
Do you guys, are you short on AGR tour or AGR vacancies in the C-17? Or, I mean, how's that look for you guys?
Dude, we don't have like, it's like a blip on the radar. So right now I'm a cord. We have 3 reserve squadrons. We have 1 AGR in each squadron. The rest are what we call Air Reserve Technician, which is a blend of like civilian GS, government service, and then a part-time reservist. And so the problem is it's hard to hire those, especially right now when the airlines are hiring like they are. Because like for me as an AGR, I can put Delta on hold for a couple of years and say, hey, I'm going to continue to do fly gray tails and then come back. But you can't do that if you're an ART. I would have had to give up my Delta position, which I'm not going to do.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That'd be silly.
Yeah. Quite.
That's so. And for those listening who are not in the reserves or the guard or have no idea what we're talking about, it's convoluted. I mean, you have AGR, like an active guardsman, basically like active duty, but in the reserves. You have ARTS, which, as you mentioned, like you're wearing a flight suit, you're flying jets like during the week, but you're a GS employee. And then at some point you become a federal employee, like on the weekends. You know, I mean, it's so convoluted. I mean,
it is.
Yeah. So it's crazy. Yeah. We made it way too complicated, I think.
I know. I mean, the moral of the story is, if the Air Force wanted, and like, I'm sure I'll get a phone call after this. I don't care if I get in trouble for this one, but
we're going to fix all, we're going to fix all,
we're
going to
fix
here.
All the problems. I mean, that's what podcasts are for, right? Fix world.
That's right.
World's problems. Yeah. If we had an abundance of AGR positions, you stop your retention problem, because even though I can't like deploy or just line of sight, tell people you're going to go do stuff. Now I probably have two, three, we'll call them chief pilots in every active duty unit. And they're there just to do your upgrades, to make sure the training gets done. They can go TDY, you know, occasionally when they ask to, yeah, on like kind of a volunteer basis. But you have that revolving door of fresh blood. And like they come in for, they get their line number with the majors. They come in for 3 or 4 years. They go back, somebody else comes in and then fills that role again. With the ART positions, I mean, they're in for the pension. So they're going to stay in that same spot for 15 yeah. years. It's tough to keep the fangs out for 15 years if you're sitting in the same seat.
It's unsustainable. And that's the problem is yes. like why people get out. It's like at some point you're just burnt out. Like Shaw's probably very similar to McCord as far as the construct of the reserves. I make that assumption, but you know, there's AGR positions, which usually had one AGR guy in each squadron, and then a couple TRs that just kind of touch base every now and then. But those AGRs, while they would do it for a few years, you have that knowledge and experience. They would go to red flag, but they wouldn't do 4 weeks out there. They might do a week and a half. Like, one, they've already paid their penance, but it's like, hey, get out there. They check the box, and it still keeps them in the game, but it's not just burning them out like everyone yeah. else. But
yeah. Maybe someone will take our advice someday, but yeah. today's probably not that day.
No, they're going to throw this right in the trash. Like, this
yeah,
is,
print a shred.
You guys are idiots. You have no idea what you're talking about. I'd like to talk a little bit about the combat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Probably some of it we really can't go too far into, but dude, so I flew around Syria and Iraq. I'm curious, because I'm assuming this is OIR type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Get your take on that environment, because quite a different environment than flying around in Afghanistan, I think.
Yeah, and the whole AOR changed in the 5+ years that I was really like in it. You went from kind of like the Wild West, where it was like enter the airspace, check in with whoever's running said airspace, taxi to type of deal. And then it was like, hey, I'm going here. This is what I'm doing. And then they're like, cool, see you later. And yeah. so you were completely on your own, you know, middle of the night, MVGs with just your crew and whatever intel you had to go make it happen. Fast forward towards the end, you know, it became as more interest get built up in the in-country, more airspace gets carved out, more procedures get layered on top. And pretty soon it's like, am I in a combat zone or am I just flying an ILS on NVGs, you know, to a full stop. So what I noticed is, and I noticed this a lot, when I periodically go back to the weapons school recently, I was sitting there during debrief and I'm asking the students these questions and I'm like, I'm just scratching my head. Like, how are you guys not picking up what I'm putting down? And finally I'm like, tell me about your last deployment. And they said, we deployed in place. So right now, like the C-17, like once Afghanistan closed down and the Middle East kind of came to a crawl, right now C-17s are like at home station in basically surge ops. So they push off a lot of the in garrison, if you will, like okay. at home admin, and they just fly out of home station. So, it's interesting to see the different upbringings, from like my year group, as I get a little bit more long in the tooth, that Wild West upbringing actually built a lot of airmanship and my comfort level ends up, yes, I've been doing this a long time, but my comfort level is much higher than some of the younger folks because they didn't have that. Good luck. We're all counting on you. Go make it happen.
Yeah.
If you don't get forced into those situations, that's true with any platform you're flying. You know, you haven't been forced to take those cognitive leaps on your own. So it's tough to not be spoon fed. You know what I mean? So yeah, I saw the full transition. It was interesting.
Well, I think that's good I like to pivot there too, because we talk about the Pacific. How do you see like emerging threats in the C-17 and like what how would the C-17 fit into like a Pacific type conflict?
Yeah, I mean, so the interesting part about the Pacific is threat wise, it's a whole different bag, right? There's a lot more nasty stuff out there. But as far as like baseline employment, the C-17 problems are still the problems we've always had, which is I have to be good at everything all the time. So I need to be able to be capable of doing the strat mission and also do like TAC missions. So short field landings, dirt strips, airdrop, obviously, all that kind of stuff. So really for us, it's figuring out how best to work and integrate with other assets. I think we could be doing a lot more, and we're starting to, but doing a lot more with the Navy and the Marines. So one of the good things about being in the reserves is we can kind of pick our pet projects, one of which is working with, we work with a Yuma Marines F-35 unit down there. Specifically, okay. We just did an op with the Black Sheep not too long ago. Had a blast. Those guys are awesome, and girls. But what we're moving towards now is basically operating as an integrated unit. So like C-17 with a fighter unit, we're going to go, you know, like take an island, hold an island, defend an island. And so we're going to working on an exercise right now. That's going to happen on the West Coast, probably like late summer, early fall. That is going to be exactly that. So like we bring in the mobile radar support, and we'll do integrated combat turns with them. So basically like fight our way in, land, and then rearm, refuel the fighters. They take off, enter a cap, and then we're going to continue to basically enter a planning cycle for the mobility side of how do we keep that fob, if you will, open. So it's an interesting problem set. And then how do you do that with hypersonic glide vehicle type weapons? How do you do that with any dozen number of red air intercept type fields that you might have? So the cool thing is the exercise we're working on, I can launch out of Portland. I can launch out of Fresno, like all the fighter units up and down the West Coast. I think it'll be an interesting test of how well we can make that happen. So we've been told pretty clearly you need to be able to operate up to and including, you know, like first island chain type of stuff. It's scary for us because I don't know if you know this, we don't have data link across the entire fleet. So no. I have two roll on kits, give or take, at McCord. And so like being able to train with those is not a plentiful opportunity. So the proficiency is not there. They're a saddle based system. So we're like, for those that are not tracking that, that's a very archaic, like nobody's really using that anymore. So even if I have it, my ability to get any information through it is I'm reliant on somebody else to push that information. Like if you were, you know, flying the Viper with your systems, like we can't share readily, which is a problem. So,
hey, maybe ignorance is bliss in this type scenario.
Well, you know what? When everybody's stuff gets jammed and I'm the only one that's used to like taking all my essay in through my ear, because that's what we have to do. I got a paper bullseye chart and I got six radios plus, and I'm just trying to set all my volumes to different differential levels so I know who's talking to me on what net, and trying to absorb as much of the war as I can through my ear.
Ooh, yeah. The FARP aspect, was that forward air refueling platform? Is that
point? Yeah.
You don't do that. Raptors doing it with a C-17 up in Elmendorf maybe like 6 months ago?
Yeah. I mean,
that ties into this capability, right? Be able to take a bunch of fuel and what you need to go into an outbase, refuel the fighters so they can cap.
Yeah. So there's a nebulous conversation of what constitutes a FARP and what doesn't. But to your point, yeah, that's part of the ask for us is to basically bring the whole back shop to the fighters. So I got to bring all the munitions and the gas to be able to keep them running. And then honestly, we also kind of can end up operating as like a C2 type platform, depending on what I roll onto the back of our jet. That's the great thing about one of the great things about the C-17, aside from its handling capability for its size is I can roll pretty much anything onto the back of that jet, lock it in place, and we're ready to ride. So it makes it a really versatile and usable platform in that dynamic environment for Indo-PACOM. Because maneuver is going to be the key. Like, I got to be agile. Like, I can't, I can't just do the things we've always done.
Random question. How much weight can a C-17 carry?
It's like 100 and it depends on the configuration, but it's like upwards of a, like our max weight is 585,000 pounds. That's total for the jet. So it's pretty massive.
Couple pounds.
Just a few.
Couple pounds. Yeah. It's going to be light on the brakes. Come stopping.
Yep. Hey, well, they spent, I think they spent more money on the brakes in the back of the aircraft than they did on the avionics. So it's a,
It's a trade-off, you know.
It's a trade-off. Being
able to stop is a good thing, but
yeah,
you just need a couple steer points. Although I know you got a lot better stuff than a couple steer points.
It's like we can. I mean, we're full up as far as like RNAV approaches and all that kind of navigation stuff, and easy peasy. No Cat 3 though. I don't know if you got that in your on your jet.
But. Well, the 777 definitely has a Cat 3.
Yeah,
that thing can land. It can land itself, you know, literally, and then
Cat 2 for us is all we got.
Well, Cat 2, that's still pretty low.
I'll get you there.
Yeah. can't do that in a Viper, though. The old duck under approach. Your time at the Missile Defense Agency. This is one thing I was like, I know it exists. I don't know anything about it. What was your time like there?
So Missile Defense Agency, I had the opportunity to go at Mission Command that, which was awesome. Definitely one of the coolest experiences I had. And it was definitely the first time that I was able to lead a team that wasn't all aviators. So we had, speaking of roll on kits, they had basically all their telemetry systems rolled on and locked into the back of the jet. So they had, I want to say there was a probably 10 or 12 workstations in the back of the jet that were monitoring what they call the target. So the target is an MRBM, so medium range ballistic missile. It's about 60,000 pounds. And what we would do is fly to some random point in the Pacific that they would just give you like the coordinates. Like, here's your lat long, go here. I need you to be plus or minus 1 second on your time tolerance to drop this thing. And then it would sustain under shoot and then launch. So the motor would kick off and it would blast towards usually Kodiak, Alaska. Now they can move the site, but those folks had to find, fix, and then track that thing and blow it out of the sky. So it was a test for our missile defense, which was a cool thing to just showcase. It's all open source, by the way. You can go, I know Fox News had a whole video on it. It shows like the IR camera imagery and stuff like that. So it's hundreds of people to make this 1 second in time happen where this missile flies out the back of a C-17 at 25,000 feet.
That's wild. Hypersonics that's going to be a whole nother problem set, but that'd be pretty cool. So I mean, is that like a 1 year, 2 year gig that you get chopped off that you're,
I mean, it's like additional duty, right? So it moves up the priority list as far as other things you have to do. So you usually go and observe the previous one, get some handoff. And then my last one was in 2017. So, if memory serves, I think it was like an 18 month cycle that they would plan and then go execute on. So it was definitely a good time. Had a lot of good friends on that trip. A lot of the civilian folks are just out there doing the JOB, like making things happen. So it was a good time. And it was a month in Hawaii, so I can't complain about that.
Hey, thank you for your service, which I did. Yeah. Just seeing all the most recent TDOI you went on, I was like, that looked like a real hardship tour. So thanks.
It sure was. Now, to be fair, MDA, I spent a month in Yuma as well before that. Yeah, so life's about balance, you know?
You know, I also spent about a month in Yuma, but I'll say, you know, Yuma, while hot this time of year, not as bad, still warm, but really patriotic town. At least that was my experience. Like everyone was, you know, if you were in your uniform, like you didn't buy lunch or anything, it was pretty impressive.
Maybe it was changed. It was a pretty good, it was not bad. I'll tell you that. It was hot, like fry an egg on the ramp hot, but just take me back to my Laughlin days, trying to start the flight line in June.
Did you imagine Laughlin has sunshades, right?
Not when I was there.
Okay. That's like Columbus has sunshades.
But I'm old, so they might have.
Yeah. real. I want to say Shepherd might have been like the last one to get sunshades.
Yeah.
Doing pilot training, having been a FAPE and sitting in the back, like on someone's dollar ride, and you're just like July, even under the sunshades, just baking.
It's
just
I didn't know you were a FAPE. That's cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just I remember around. Like, you never forget your first flight, you know, with the T6 and your instructor's just like, get the motor cranked, get the AC on, like, let's effing go, dude.
Yeah. I don't care if you're going to miss a bunch of stuff anyways, but can we please just get this thing cranked up?
Yep.
That's all I care about. That's going to be the difference between a good ride and a bad ride for you. So that's all that matters. There you go.
Auto hook if you don't get the air on inside of 60 seconds.
Yeah. It's the only thing that matters. You want to pressure IP, get that thing cranked as fast as humanly possible. And now they got all the, you know, 3D, I don't know, goggles and stuff like that. So it should be super easy practicing versus an old paper chart.
Yep.
Talk to me about C-17. What's the most challenging aspect of flying the C-17, you think, for you or for most people in general, if you could pinpoint such a thing?
I think the C-17 is an incredibly easy aircraft to learn up to the intermediate level. I think it's very difficult to take it beyond intermediate into the expert level. And, you know, I've been doing this since 2009. I still learn something new almost every time I fly. So, you know, the jet at high speeds, talking above 300 knots, you can get a 40 degree per second roll rate out of this thing, which is wild. It's like, you know, people are like, what's it like flying the C-17? And the only thing I can describe it as, it's like the NFL lineman that can somehow run a 4.5 40.
It's a good way.
Like, you look at the jet and you're like, there's no way that it can do the things that you see it do, but it can. And also learning the jet does talk to you, but it's very nebulous. You kind of have to know the systems and what they're telling you at any given time to keep yourself safe when you're kind of trying to push it out toward that outer limit. So that's the toughest thing. As far as specifically flying the jet in general, like I said before, it's just trying to do everything all the time is incredibly difficult, and stay good at everything all the time is a problem for us.
I will piggyback on that. If you haven't seen the C-17 demo, for those who are listening, that's an impressive demo to watch. I mean, it's a big old plane maneuvering in a small piece of the sky.
Yep.
The assault landing, or the short field landing demo portion of it, and backing up, like I can respect. That's a big old plane to be whipping that thing around like that.
I love it and I hate it. And I'll tell you why. That, like, they do an amazing job with the demo. Like, I've never seen like a bad demo, right, from our guys and gals. But they are pretty limited on what they can do. Like, they're limited to 45 degrees of bank, not 60. And a lot of that just, you know, comes from our, you know, loss of a C-17 at the Elmendorf incident. So, you know, we don't need to get into all that, but I think there's a lot of kind of trauma, if you will, that's in the back of people's minds. And especially at the higher levels, people writing the books don't want to let that go. I think it's a bummer. Cause I think it keeps our community from learning some of those things that would get them towards the top 10% of what the jet can do. They just never get an opportunity to see and learn it, because that's kind of the mentality, is to be more conservative.
Yeah, that's unfortunate when that mindset creeps in. Obviously, there's a balance of, you know, risk versus reward. So the tactical pop pattern for the F-16, you know, you're doing 500 feet and you're popping up into the thousands of feet and rolling in, acquiring a target. It's dumb bomb delivery.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a great part task trainer, in my opinion, because you're doing so many things. And having your cross check has to be so fast, but it was one of those things like, we're not doing this anymore in combat, so why would we do this again? Like, it's a risk you're buying. And there'll be a lot of people that disagree with me, but like that, I was like, there's other aspects of flying the F-16 and other fighters, right, that you want to work the eye-hand coordination and the muscle memory and jog the brain. But doing, like, pop patterns, like, I think you got to be – got to be on your A game to make it happen. And they still do it, but it's like the ebbs and flows, like, oh, we're not doing it. It's too risky. I mean, yeah, sure. You could smack a bird at 500 feet and 500 knots, but you could also do that in other spots and other parts of the airspace. But
yeah, there's, I mean, any given training sortie that I go on, like I probably do something that is more risky than the demo profile. So, you know, it's just my personal opinion, right? Like I get up on my high horse about this kind of stuff, but I would love to see us kind of move forward, learn from our history, and to make us better, not to keep us rooted in the past.
Yeah. Flip side, I don't know how many, because there was one point an East Coast and a West Coast demo. I know it went back and forth for the C-17, just like it did for all the fighter ones. All the fighter ones are just a single one now. But yeah, doing that from my background, it's like you got to do that not every day, right? But that needs to be your primary focus. Sure. So if you do cuff it, and most people, at least the F-16, all you got to do is just make loud noise and everyone's like, oh, this is great. No one knows. Like, it's a Falcon turn he's doing there. Like, what's that? Well, if you do that in real life, you're going to get shot. But it looks cool in the air show. So that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. Air shows don't always, certainly don't translate to combat ops. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's like, look at its maneuverability as it soaks up an SA whatever, you know, it's like, boom, man, he's dead. But man, it's loud. So that's, it gets the people excited.
Mm-hmm.
As we get close to wrapping up here, can you talk to me about some of the, I guess, things that are on the horizon for the C-17 or that, you know, they're coming down the pipe or need to come down the pipe to stay viable?
Yeah, I think so. We're rushing to field a lot of the capabilities that I alluded to before that are gaps. So we're trying to catch up on the data link side of things. We're working on Rapid Dragons now open source. So that's the ability to deliver standoff munitions from the back of a C-17. So that basically looks like, and the upside is how many we can deliver. So, you know, dozens and dozens, depending on the configuration. I can now do that as a C-17 and allow, you know, our fourth and fifth gen fighters and bombers to do the more precision, like deep strike type of stuff, but still help like shape the battle space, basically starts the whole phasing of the war a step prior. So like the C-17s can do that. Now we can get our fifth gen in, roll the IADs back further with the fourth gen, you know, backpacking in and making that stuff happen. So will we use that? I kind of hope not, because that means some really wild stuff's about to happen. But at the same time, it's a on the horizon capability that I think we need to chase that rabbit. And with that, like, what else can we do? You know, like launching decoys, launching like different types of swarm drone capabilities. Once we've proven the Rapid Dragon program in its current form, you know, that there's endless possibilities of what you do with it. So those two things for sure. And then just continuing as we close the gap in our capabilities, making sure that works with what the other platforms are doing, right? It does me no good to like fix a problem if I can't talk to anybody else that I'm working with, right? So if I go and like get data link that doesn't talk to anybody else, now what good is it? So I hope that's my big concern is as we go through this, you know, what making sure that we get the right effects to bridge the gap as opposed to just closing the gap for the sake of fixing something.
Perfect. Yeah, it's interesting to hear about that. And I think how the world has changed and then limitations as far as budgets and what we want, all these things, it kind of forces the hand to be creative and pursue these different avenues to really leverage strengths and weaknesses on the different platforms between different aircraft. So as we wrap up here, if you found 15, 16-year-old Prada walking down the street, is there any advice you'd give him?
You know, I thought about that a lot you know, we talked about before, kind of before we got on, like the reserves kind of being the best kept secret in the Air Force, but I would do what I did. What I would tell cadet or Lieutenant Wade, I would say, like, make sure you master yourself first before you like go out and try to do some other big goal. I know for me, like, I sprinted so hard trying to get in the aviation and then making as far as I could in the C-17. You know, I arrived at like somewhere around the 30, 33 year old Prada and was like still dealing with a lot of like internal stuff. So I definitely did not take care of myself the way I should have. And I probably would have been a better aviator, definitely a better instructor, because I would have been able to communicate with people better. So that would be my biggest thing. And just the number of pluses that would come from mastering those communication skills and kind of like my own emotional intelligence earlier in life would have probably paid huge dividends for myself and those around me. So, and I think that'd be good for anybody to work on.
Dude, I love it. I hope you hang around for a There I Was story. Yeah. But dude, thanks for taking the time. It was great to chat and learn a little bit more about you and the C-17.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description again to get 14 days free.